first line treatment for adolescents with anorexia now is family-based therapy, typically, which involves helping the parents facilitate the refeeding of the adolescent. So I was working with the patient in that way and found it to be helpful and useful, but was consistently struck by the neglect of the patient's inner life and found, you know, at least in my experience with many patients, that while you could get some symptomatic relief, if you didn't in some way address the deeper dynamics, the aspects of the patient's personality organization that drove the disorder, that were implicated in the disorder, there was a way that the patient would snap back to their old behaviors over time. That deeper change and a deeper understanding of what was going on was really necessary. And so that's been the kind of evolution of my work over the past 10 years from, you know, my first book, which was about anorexia in males, and tried to present a kind of integrative understanding of that phenomena. Increasingly over time, I've become more and more interested in the deeper kind of analytic thinking that we can bring to bear on this kind of suffering.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This podcast consists of conversations with psychoanalysts from around the world who share with us their clinical and psychoanalytic work with individuals both on and off the couch. And what we mean by off the couch is that they share with us their community involvement in many different venues apart from their consultation rooms. They describe their work in hospitals, in community clinics, in refugee centers, in classrooms, indeed in war zones. We also have conversations with psychoanalysts who are focusing their work on the couch, and they are continuing to refine both our familiar and novel understandings of the dynamic mind as it presents itself in the analytic situation. We've been talking to elders in our field, people who've been practicing for 50 plus years, and they share with us how they view this field evolving and where they see it going. We also talk to clinicians who had professions prior to becoming psychoanalysts, and they share with us their journeys to doing what they now love. These are just samplings of the psychoanalysts we've been talking with, again, from all corners of the globe. Please visit our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can subscribe, where you can see the recommended readings provided by our guests, and you can also leave a comment. I hope you enjoy these conversations and find them thoughtful and meaningful, and I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Tom Waldridge. Tom has written widely in the field of eating disorders, and our conversation today focuses on a recent book of his entitled Eating Disorders, A Contemporary Introduction. And we unpack what it means to understand and engage with somebody who is struggling with eating disorders, what is happening in the patient, what's happening as a consequence in the analyst, and how one unpacks that for the good of the work and for the good of the patient's development. He makes a point, and in fact, when I ask him at the end for his wish list for the future, his wish list includes that there be better integration between the dynamic and the adynamic approaches, that there is great utility in family approaches and behavioral and pharmacologic treatments, and without taking anything away from the importance of listening to the inner lives of these patients, even as they themselves don't have access to their inner lives. We consider issues of alexithymia, family structures that commonly lead to these somatizing type of reactions, the role of the paternal function, desire, prior trauma, and in particular, the abject, the relationship to the body that is contaminated with that way of experiencing oneself, others, and one's mother. It's a full, rich description and discussion of our work, and I learned a great deal, and I hope you find it as well. Tom is a chair in the Department of Psychology at Golden Gate University, as well as a psychoanalyst and a board-certified licensed psychologist. As I say, he's written widely. His first book was called Understanding Anorexia Nervosa in Males. His second book was Psychoanalytic Treatment of Eating Disorders, When Words Fail and Bodies Speak, a marvelous title. And the book we're discussing today is called Eating Disorders, and it's a series from Routledge, New Introductions to Contemporary Psychoanalysis. He has a fourth book, co-edited, that is entitled Advancing Psychotherapy for the Next Generation, Rehumanizing Mental Health Policy and Practice. And he has done also what many of us wish to do, and some of us have done. He's written a novel about the process of psychotherapy called Ghosts of the Unremembered Past. He is a personal and supervising analyst at the Psychoanalytic Institute for Northern California and a training analyst at the San Francisco Center for Psychoanalysis. He is on the Scientific Advisory Council of the National Eating Disorders Association, on the faculty at the Psychoanalytic Institute of Northern California, the Northern California Society for Psychoanalytic Psychology, the William Allenson White Institute's Eating Disorders, Compulsions, and Addictions Programs, and the San Francisco Center for Psychoanalysis. And he has a private practice in Berkeley, California. He's a busy man and a deeply thoughtful man. And I hope you find this as educational and interesting as I did. Here's my conversation with Dr. Tom Wooldridge. Tom, welcome to the podcast. So good to have you here. Tom, we're here today to discuss the eating disorders, and they're a unique clinical phenomena in many ways that we'll unpack today. One of the ways is how intense they are, and what I'm referring to by intensity is if anyone has had the experience, either friend, relative, clinician, of sitting with a patient with anorexia in front of a plate of food, and you observe the fullness of this person's hunger being collapsed into an all-encompassing no, it's really remarkable. And one of the ways it's remarkable is the way it evokes in the observer an enormous reaction. As powerful and all-encompassing is the patient's no, the observer, an interested observer, will have often an equally all-encompassing, intense yes. Why won't you eat this food? Kind of thing, and it becomes frenzy in the observer. Likewise, with patients who either report or you actually witness are in the midst of a binge purge cycle, you encounter something quite unique. It's a seeker behavior. The person is often dissociated, out of contact, out of control, has no choice to stop themselves, and yet all the observer wants to do is to contain them and make them stop. Now, we'll talk more about that communication of affects, if you will, where the observer carries so much feeling. But it's important to mention from the beginning that the temptation to behaviorally intervene when it is driven by that transference intensity is not useful. That said, the importance to behaviorally intervene from an object-oriented intention, from a clinical medical intention, is at times vital, if not life-saving. And while today we will be discussing the dynamic understanding of what leads to these symptoms, as vital as that is for ongoing depth treatment, we need to honor the many, many people in other fields who have also devoted themselves to this work and make important contributions. People in family therapy, in cognitive behavioral therapy, in pharmacotherapy, especially as it applies to the frenzied, out-of-control binges. Medications can really soften the intensity and overwhelming quality of that, making them more amenable to treatment. And there's even some research lately on the role of psychedelics in, again, softening the intensities of these ways of being that these patients struggle with. And you emphasize, and we'll be discussing, the important role that the analyst has in working with a team. Before we get to that, we're going to take up some of your ideas, the concepts, and unpack them. And then we're going to get to a case that you've worked with for many years, also in conjunction with other clinicians. And then we'll consider the field at large. But I want to start us off by reading a few sentences early in your book. The book is entitled Eating Disorders, A Contemporary Introduction. And you say the following: the objects that populate her psyche, and by that you're referring to either whole or part objects, the objects that populate her psyche shape the anxieties with which she struggles, longings she feels, and the defenses she erects to manage the intensities of both. From this point of view, it is the underlying psychological structure, not just the eating disorder symptoms that manifest because of it, not just the eating disorder symptoms that manifest because of it, that are the focus of treatment. The eating disorder, in other words, is a result of dynamics that are woven through the patient's personality. These ideas also provide a way for us to think about how our patients are interacting with us moment by moment in our world. And your last sentence is important, that it enables us to think about how our patients are interacting with us. In other words, these are not just theoretical constructs. They provide a map for how we can more carefully listen and experientially be attuned to what's happening in the room between the two people. With that as an introduction, Tom, do you want to share a little bit about your thinking and how you understand that important inner life in the presence of these symptoms?
Yeah, thank you for the invitation, Harvey, and for the, you know, really compelling introduction. I think that your description of anorexia and of binge purge disorders, the intensity of the patient's no or the frenzy of the patient's binge and the accompanying countertransference and how the two are polarized is really compelling. You know, before we started, we were talking a little bit about my kind of early training and my initial interest in family therapy, and in particular, structural family therapy. And some of the listeners might know the work of Salvador Mnuchin and his early work on families of patients with anorexia. When I was a doctoral student, I had a patient, a young male patient with anorexia, and was being trained in that model and how to intervene in that way. And I found it very compelling and very useful. And in fact, you know, referencing back to your acknowledgement that there are many forms of intervention that are very important, including behavioral and family interventions, the first line treatment for adolescents with anorexia now is family-based therapy, typically, which involves helping the parents facilitate the refeeding of the adolescent. So I was working with the patient in that way and found it to be helpful and useful, but was consistently struck by the neglect of the patient's inner life, and found, you know, at least in my experience with many patients, that while you could get some symptomatic relief, if you didn't in some way address the deeper dynamics, the aspects of the patient's personality organization that drove the disorder, that were implicated in the disorder, there was a way that the patient would snap back to their old behaviors over time. That deeper change and a deeper understanding of what was going on was really necessary. And so that's been the kind of evolution of my work over the past 10 years, from, you know, my first book, which was about anorexia in males, and tried to present a kind of integrative understanding of that phenomena. Increasingly over time, I've become more and more interested in the deeper kind of analytic thinking that we can bring to bear on this kind of suffering.
You know, it's sort of the paradox that the treatment modalities that are outside an awareness or even a curiosity about the patient's inner life parallels for many, not all, for many of these patients, their own unawareness of their inner life. And perhaps, do you think that the reason that the treatments, at least early on, were so focused away from that, because that was the only way they could reach the patient? I remember you mentioned Sal Mnuchin. I grew up during his day here in Philadelphia, and he was a sort of a larger-than-life man who wrote important work on family structural family therapy. And he said that the reason that we don't ask people or try to discover their inner lives is because they can't do anything with that type of curiosity. They just register it as a thing, a behavior. And we're going to talk about alexithymia in a little bit. And so he thought that the treatment had to be behavioral. That is, who sits next to whom and who's talking to whom and how you arrange the family lunch table and things like that. But I take it from what you're saying that you think, again, not for all, but for many patients, that even though they start off not having access to their affective life, much less their fantasy life, that keeping in mind that it's present can be useful to eventually helping them reach that.
I think that that is absolutely true. I think it also links back to the way you started us off, that if we don't have a more comprehensive case formulation, including an understanding of what's going on in the patient and in ourselves, our interventions are much more likely to be driven by countertransference pressure. I do agree with you that most interventions, contemporary interventions, they mirror the kind of lack of interior understanding in the patient and that they are behaviorally focused. I think it's also true that, you know, so many of the patients that come to us with eating disorders are children and adolescents. Mm. And it's a very painful thing for families who are often terrified for the well-being of their child. It's a very painful thing for them to contemplate the inner life of that child who is, you know, in such distress.
Which touches upon, and we're going to read a bit, your reference to the family members. Yes, parents are terrified. There's no question. It's a horrifying experience to see your child so out of control, so destructive. And important to keep in mind that anorexia is the psychiatric condition with the highest mortality in all of psychiatry. And that's, I mean, there's many things to scare someone about the condition, but that's certainly one of them in additional. That brings us to this issue of alexithymia. And let me read just a sentence you wrote about it. You write, quote, "Alexithymia can be understood as a deficit in the capacity for mentalization, with affects largely being expressed through the first two registers, somatic and motoric, and with little capacity for tolerance, containment, and abstraction." Now, when I read that, it brought to mind, a long time ago, I was involved in the psychosomatic discussion group of the American Psychoanalytic, some of the early, really courageous researchers, analytic researchers in this world, not just with eating disorders, but also with eating disorders. And they would often have debates with each other, at times contentious, about this issue of alexithymia. There were those who insisted that it was a defense no different than any other defense, and that if you saw it as that and stayed attuned to the inner life of the patient, you would eventually discover, as they feel they do with other defenses, the underlying life. And there were other equally adamant and experienced clinicians who felt, no, this was really a different entity, that it wasn't just like repression or splitting or dissociation. Now, what's important to note is that in the decades since these conversations took place, our field has importantly advanced. We now understand that there's a new source, a greater source of information than just is it or isn't it. And that is, as we've been talking about, it's in the countertransference. That is, that's what we didn't know those decades ago to listen to try to discern what was actually going on with the patient. And I think that's one of the great advances in psychoanalysis over the past decades that does give us access to, like you say, those first two registers, the somatic and the motoric. But the challenge remains, how does one work with it? Because if their language, their love language, if you will, is somatic and motoric, and the analyst is just talking, how does a match take place? How does the patient feel understood and experienced if we're at different registers?
Yeah, thank you. I think that's an astute question. So I do find the model of mentalization, and just to clarify, this is not Fonagy's mentalization with a Z, which is, you know, about the capacity to interpret behavior in terms of mental states. This is a kind of umbrella idea of mentalization from an article by Lacours and Bouchard that thinks about inner life in terms of these four different registers: somatic, motoric, images, and then verbal, or, you know, mm-hmm. words. I think of it in terms of a Bionian model. So, you know, I often use this idea of container contained, and we're with the patient. They're always communicating, whether it's in a representational form, words and images, or a non-representational form, pains in their bodies, bodily movement, nonverbal expressions. And I pay a lot of attention to my own reverie. I'm using my own symbolic capacities to try to scaffold them into the world of representation. And obviously that requires a lot of gentleness and patience and tolerance for deadness and discomfort. But I have found that with these patients, I can wait patiently for something to show up in my mind, an image, a metaphor, a phrase, and, you know, often can find a way to give that back to them. And, you know, if I'm lucky, it sometimes is something that they can start to make use of over time.
And when you say make use of, you mean begin to expand their registers so that it's not just limited to the somatic and motoric.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. You know, and I think that that is a more contemporary understanding that two minds come together to scaffold the patient into the representational world.
Along the way, in my experience and many, one goes through one's own version of the somatic motoric experiences that we are immersing ourselves into. It can make for an awkward after work, use the word reverie. It doesn't feel very reverie-like. It feels more infiltrated-like, state of mind. I assume that's not unfamiliar to you?
Absolutely. I think, you know, we often have to bear very painful mental states in this process. You know, we have to bear our own somatic experience, our own sort of wish, you know, like you described in the beginning, to intervene forcefully, to make the patient eat. You know, all of that has to be withstood and understood. And I think that speaks to the way that in the field within the larger mental health treatment of eating disorders, there is such a pull towards behavioral intervention, because it's very hard to stay with that.
It does ask a lot. Yes. Let's talk about families. We began referencing the family therapy work, and the patient we're going to discuss had some exposure to family therapy work. What you write, again, this is a very brief summary of it, you write, in the families of a child who develops anorexia nervosa, the mother's use of the child to maintain her own equilibrium makes separation and individuation more difficult. In such families, a potentially important factor in whether the child goes on to develop anorexia nervosa is the strength of the paternal function, which optimally helps the child learn how to appropriately deploy his aggression in the service of separation and individuation. In these families, however, the relative absence of the paternal function may lead the anorectic to be to locate his experience of agency in relation to eating and his body, which he rigidly controls. There's a lot in that. Well, why don't you start us off?
Yeah. So, you know, I want to just add the caveat that I think that, you know, eating disorders are a heterogeneous bunch of disorders. So we've got anorexia, bulimia, binge eating, muscle dysmorphia, ARFID. So a whole range of conditions, and presumably those conditions have different, you know, developmental pathways that lead to them. And I think this idea of equifinality is also important, that there, for each disorder, are likely multiple pathways to get to that disorder. And there may even be different variants of the same disorder. And so I wouldn't want to overly generalize. Sure. About family structure. That said, you know, to take anorexia, which is often used, I think, somewhat misleadingly as the kind of prototypical eating disorder, you know, Hilda Brook was somebody who very early on described anorexia in the language of object relations. And she would describe a overly intrusive or kind of symbiotic relation between mother and child, which, yes, made the efforts of the child to separate and individuate more difficult, compromised the child's interoceptive capacities, their ability to know about their inner life. And the father was given less attention, but was frequently described by Brooke and by many, many others in the analytic literature as absent or less involved. There's been writing about the phenomenon of father hunger in adolescence with anorexia, kind of longing for a psychological father. So some of my interest has been in this idea of the paternal function. And just to, you know, add the caveat that I think this idea of maternal and paternal functions, it's a complicated kind of terminology given the gendered associations of those terms. I just want to add that, you know, I recognize that those terms can marginalize differently configured families. We're really talking about two different sets of functions that could be carried by either gender or distributed in different ways. That said, I've been interested in the way that the father can facilitate or fail to facilitate the child's separation and individuation from the mother. Some of my interest has been in the way that fathers can promote the child's healthy relationship with their own aggression and self-assertion. So, you know, I've looked at, say, the phenomenon of rough and tumble play, the way that fathers can engage with their children in a kind of play that is disruptive. And the father titrates his own aggression, facilitates the child's expression of their own aggression in an appropriate amount. And my idea has been that facilitates the child's experience of themselves as agentic, as able to kind of push up against the world in a way that allows them to feel that they're having an impact. And I often think about that, you know, the phenomenon of rough and tumble play as a kind of metaphor in relation to the child's ability to move out into the world and explore away from the maternal orbit.
And you relate that to eating disorders how?
In the sense that I think that people with eating disorders, or many people with eating disorders, maybe especially anorexia, often have very complicated relationships with their mothers that, you know, as Hilda Brook originally observed, that relationship can often be enmeshed. You know, Mnuchin also talked about that. And so, you know, often a developmental task for these young people is solidifying and developing a sense of self apart from the family, apart from mother, connected to, but distinct from.
And one of the things that you would hope would develop from that autonomy from, though not disconnection from, as you point out, from mother and a kind of a playful engagement with father, is the capacity to recognize desire. And, you know, very early on in the field, there was sort of like a glib characterization of patients, for example, who would have binge eating disorder. They would say, oh, well, they're hungry for their mother. And it was said sort of as glibly as I just said it. But you very aptly and very nicely, as I'm about to read, recognize that that really doesn't capture what this is about. So let me read what you write about desire. You say, patients with eating disorders often struggle to tolerate desire, instead engaging in repeated and immediate action as a means of foreclosing the experience of wanting. You go on to say, a patient with bulimia, for example, may not desire food as a substitute for mother, but rather because that is the only available, quote, vocabulary through which her desire can be expressed. the analyst's task becomes not only to uncover desires that have been defended against, but also to help the patient begin to want freely so that over time, new containers of desire can emerge both inside and outside the analytic relationship. It's very important. Can you elaborate for us?
Yeah. I mean, I've been in my thinking very influenced by an essay by Judith Brisman. I think it was called Wanting, published in Contemporary Psychoanalysis. And she distinguishes between two different ways of thinking about desire. One is the more classical way, which is that we come into the world with a kind of pre-wired set of desires that seek expression. And the second is a more postmodern or constructivist way of thinking about desire, that desire is dependent on our relational and cultural context and the containers that are available for it. Another language you could think about this in that I think applies to the binge eating example that you gave is that, I think babies come into the world as, kind of wired for emotional auto-regulation, self-regulation. And then very quickly, they start to seek out an experience of emotional co-regulation with their attachment figure. They look to their caregivers to help them regulate their affect, including their desire. For people with eating disorders, or with binge eating disorder in particular, something presumably has gone wrong along the way. They've had an experience where co-regulation has failed. They haven't been able to look to their objects to maintain a certain kind of emotional equilibrium. They've found instead that regulation, in quotes, in their relationship to food. Food is the thing that they've turned to find comfort. I so often hear stories of patients who, as adults or adolescents struggle with binge eating disorder, who earlier in life felt alone or cast out or abandoned in some way. And so they turn to, food for comfort. Would we say that the food represents or is a kind of symbolic expression of the desire for mother? I think, we could interpret it that way, standing outside of it. But I'm not sure that that's the internal experience of these patients, or at least some of these patients, for whom, they often don't have access to a sense of what it would be like to be comforted by another person.
Let's spend a moment on that. People who early on in their lives have a sense of loneliness, which, of course, is not limited to patients. It's a fairly universal human phenomena, and it's certainly not limited to patients who develop eating disorders. A question I have is whether the people who either develop such major symptomatology, often life-crippling symptomatology, and or the people who end up in our offices and talk about the loneliness, whether they're the people who, yes, are lonely, but are those who unknowingly make it very difficult, if not impossible, for people to actually reach out to them. Because obviously loneliness is a two-person system. You need someone to be interested in you in a caring way, and you also have to be open to receive it. And oftentimes, if someone's in our office, it's because that's a select group of people who, yes, were lonely, but didn't understand that the very thing they said they wanted wasn't something that they were actually open to receiving. And you make the point in the book often, and you're beautifully careful to not fall into mother blaming or father blaming, because you point out in your case examples that the person contributes as well. And I just want to include that in our understanding, that we're not pointing fingers at anybody.
Yeah. I think that is certainly the case, and these situations are complicated. So maybe just to flesh out the binge eating disorder example a little bit, I think there are often multiple things going on for these people. So there's for many patients, potentially a kind of neurological component. Mm-hmm. There's a high overlap between ADHD and binge eating disorder, for example. I wouldn't just want to locate it in kind of attachment functioning of the child. binge eating disorder is also, I believe, that the eating disorder where the evidence of prior trauma is most clearly empirically established. So, you know, for binge eating disorder, there's a very, very high percentage of people that fall into that category that have a prior history of physical, verbal, or sexual childhood abuse or neglect. So I think that accounts for the kind of overt expression of dissociative defenses mm-hmm. in that population. For people with binge eating disorder, something has gone wrong, you know, in their early development. And then when symptoms start to appear, you know, usually in late childhood or adolescence, so much shame accrues around that experience for these people. So the experience of need itself is just incredibly fraught. And so, you know, I agree with you that they have this experience of overwhelming need, but the relationship to it is incredibly complicated. The experience of need is often managed dissociatively, for sure. One, and two, it's often laden with shame. So, you know, meeting that need is not so straightforward.
There's so much more we could say about each of these, but I want to get to another point that is very present in your work, and that is the role of the abject. And I didn't pick, there were so many examples where you describe it, but let me just turn to you without reading. Just share with us, before we get to the case, your sense of the abject and how it helps one understand the struggles of the patient with eating disorders.
Yeah. So, you know, the abject is such a complicated idea, an idea developed by Kristeva. And, you know, I don't know that I could, even having written about it, do full theoretical justice to it. But the way I understand it is that it consists of the things that are taboo, you know, words like horrific, monstrous, elements that were once part of us but have now been rejected. The fear of contamination is often associated with the abject. Things like vomit, or I think Kristeva uses the example of the skin that develops on the top of spoiled milk. It's not a stage that we pass through necessarily. We're always kind of abjecting subjects. So it's a way of describing that kind of experience that I think people with eating disorders, you know, often talk about. For Kristeva, it's also associated with the maternal. So, you know, we have to abject the mother in some sense to the mother's body to separate from her. And of course, that links to eating disorders, as we've talked about, you know, people with eating disorders, or at least anorexia, as an example, struggle with that process of separation and individuation. So in the book, the thing I'm interested in thinking about is, you know, how do we understand psychodynamically the intensity of the experience of the abject that some of these patients struggle with? And I try to give a couple of different ways of thinking about that.
You also make the point, which I think is very clinically immediate, that patients treat, at times, see their own bodies as abject, as something they feel revulsion and disgust towards.
Yeah.
And that one sees that clinically, certainly. You mentioned that she lists three types of abject, one of which is food, one of which is body waste, and the third are signs of sexual differences, which will lead us into a consideration of sexuality, conflicts over sexuality, and in what way that is or isn't present, or dare say central, to patients with eating disorders. Let's put that aside, actually, as important as it is, because I want to make sure we have time to talk about your case, Sarah. This is someone you've worked with, someone who also was in adjunctive treatment, was seeing, I think you said, a psychiatrist for medication, also had seen a nutritionist and a family therapist. But why don't you introduce her to us and then read a bit about her and your work as an example to bring all these points to life?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Yeah, as you said, Sarah was a patient I saw in analytic treatment for probably a decade, who, you know, had a treatment history prior to me as an adolescent in high school. She had been in family-based therapy, which had given her some symptomatic relief. Family-based therapy is thought of as the kind of gold standard treatment for adolescents with anorexia. It involves helping the parents take a very behavioral stance towards facilitating the child's refeeding, and can be, you know, incredibly helpful, I think, for these young people. Sarah, like many of the people I see, when she went off to college, she relapsed. And, you know, that's a complicated thing in itself that we could think about. So I'll read from page 66 of the book. Mm-hmm. Sarah was born approximately 6 weeks premature, and according to her father, the family was uncertain for several weeks whether she would live. For a substantial period, her life was maintained in an incubator, isolated from human contact. Through latency, she suffered from numerous physical complaints, including fatigue, stomach pain, and headaches. She remembers innumerable visits to doctors and hospitals, and several invasive procedures, including colonoscopies and endoscopies, were performed. In the early months of treatment, Sarah would become angry and withdrawn when I suggested possible meanings to her associations. These interactions culminated on several occasions with her curling up tightly in her chair, yelling that I was cold and cruel, while tears ran down her face. This situation, in which my interpretation seemed to evoke her early wounding, led to an impasse that persisted for several months. Despite my efforts to craft sentences that were gentle and curious, my comments often had a subtly sharp edge. I came to dread the experience of feeling that my words hurt this woman, whose physical appearance conveyed such profound fragility, yet I could not find a way of engaging with her over an extended period that avoided it. But one Friday afternoon, Sarah made a comment that brought us out of a prolonged and deadened silence, and my thinking began to shift. Looking at me without expression, she said, "It's like I'm giving you weapons to pierce me with." Certainly, this statement reflected the contribution of her early trauma in shaping our experience together. My interpretations felt piercing in the same way her earliest experiences with medical doctors had been. I continued to worry about how much she suffered in our sessions. In trying to help, I seemed to be hurting her. I often imagined her early life in an incubator, in which light and sound would have been experienced as overwhelming. And I envisioned myself as a well-intentioned physician who, in trying to save her life, pierced her skin with needles. At times, this experience of myself was overwhelming. The clinician's experience of receiving overwhelming projections in the countertransference often reflects the patient's experience of having to contend with intrusive projections in early development. While Sarah's medical history helped to explain what was happening between us, we soon learned that her early emotional life had been marked in this way. She remembered one incident that represents the intensity of her mother's projective identifications, that is, of putting her own undigested emotional experiences into her daughter. Around age 8, she had been eating a pear in her family's kitchen. When her mother walked in and saw the juice running down her chin, she became distraught and insisted that her daughter explain what, in her mind, was an overt exhibition of sexuality. Her mother's need to divest herself of her own psychotic anxieties left Sarah feeling filled up with toxic shame. This was prototypical of many of her childhood experiences in her family.
It's such a good example of the interface between the movement of affects and fantasies between family members, whereas one could hypothesize that the mother could not tolerate her own sexual feelings of whatever sort or imaginings and insisted upon seeing it in her daughter. And it was the insistence that took over the daughter's experience to the point perhaps where it would be very difficult and perhaps a long time in treatment before she could herself claim that story not only revealed something about her mother, but also revealed something about her own awkwardness with her sexual feelings, perhaps even in the transference. We don't know. But it's a it's one of those moments, it's like a hologram. You can open it up and get stories and stories about the past, about the present, about the future. And your task and your skill is to know at what point to intervene, at what level. And at this point, your intervention is based on helping her see, it sounds like, what it was like being with her mother and how it was difficult for her to separate her own experience of eating the pear and her mother's frenzy. And at a later point, perhaps, you can help her see how, so what if it was a sexual feeling? Well, we can get to know that too. That doesn't make you bad like you think your mother might think. So it's a wonderful moment. And can you give us a bit of the course of treatment that you and Sarah, who is a disguised case, of course, how that went?
Yeah. So this was in the very, early stages of the treatment. And like you said, we did have a treatment team, of course. And I think, in the example I read, you can very much see the prominence of the kind of no entry system of defense, is a term I take from Gianna Williams. Her characterological defenses are very much organized around keeping things out, including interpretations, including the analyst's words, which, requires to be with that requires so much gentleness and patience. Time, it takes time for trust to accrue. I think in that example, you can also see what Gianna Williams would talk about as the reversal of container contained, the way that the mother uses the child as a receptacle for mm-hmm. her own anxieties, her own conflicts. And so, the early phase of treatment was very much working on this kind of characterological structure, this defensive structure. It took a long time for us to get to a place where, we could stand a little more outside of that, where there could be a kind of fuller exploration. In those early stages, there was very much a sense that that anything I said had the potential to create a lot of wounding. Right. So it was a complex treatment that went on over time, and it was not really until about 5 years in that there was a substantial symptomatic resolution. So, in those early years when I would be away from the office or go on vacation or whatever, there would often, even though there were other providers and there was coverage, there would often be a kind of increase in the restrictive behaviors.
That was the only way she could express that she missed you.
I think that's really right. And in my experience, that didn't remit until this sort of no entry system and the larger kind of characterological structure could be worked on to a sufficient degree. It was really about 5 years in. I can remember pretty distinctly. I was away for a couple of weeks and I came back and she was really able to talk for the first time about the experience of missing me, and the quality of relatedness was really different than it had been in the past.
How lovely.
Yeah. The final, 5 years of the treatment were really spent. They looked much more like what we'd think of as a kind of traditional analysis. They were really spent, working on different aspects of her psyche that certainly, were intertwined with what had been her initial symptomatic presentation, but were no longer so tightly linked to it.
What a terrific outcome. There's so much more for us to talk about, one of which is, let's just make passing mention to, because there has been in the past so much attention to whether these separation, individuation conflicts are a defensive screen for sexual conflicts, and likewise, when sexual conflicts are a defensive screen for earlier conflicts. And both are always true. The experience of a clinician will lead one to have a sense of what the surface is at any particular moment, and the surface can shift quickly from one to the other. Can you walk us through how you see this?
Yeah, I mean, I think the way that you put it, that it's always both, I think I would agree with that. But I would also say that clinically for me, I would tend to think of sexual conflicts, or I would find it most salient, I think, most of the time, to think of sexual conflicts as secondary. Now, there are some exceptions, you know, people who have histories of sexual abuse or the like. But I tend to be more interested in the kind of early object relational mm-hmm. attachment experiences, the experience of object hunger in particular. You know, this kind of experience of kind of recurrent disappointed need for connection, and the person can't then internalize the significant other and use that internalization for self-regulation and self-soothing. I see that, you know, often as a piece of what's conflicted about the adolescent's sexual experience. So, you know, eating disorders so often they manifest in adolescence. And I think that is a period, it's a kind of second separation and individuation. Mm-hmm. It's a period when object hunger is heightened. It's a period where genital sexuality comes to the fore. And genital sexuality is very much, I think, for adolescents, an expression of that object hunger. And so, you know, my understanding would be that's at least a piece of how the pieces fit together. Of course, this idea of abjection, also very mm-hmm. much related to sexuality, sexual difference. It's probably an overdetermined phenomena.
Let me jump ahead and let me ask you, where you would like to see the field of eating disorders. And by that, I'm referring to two fields, one of which is the general field of eating disorders, and in particular, the analytic field of eating disorders. How you would like to see it in 5-10 years from now, if you could have your way.
Yeah. Well, I like this idea of two fields. So we've got, you know, analytic thinking about eating disorders, and then we've got the larger mental health treatment community. And mm-hmm. I think what I'd say is I'd really like to see them talk to each other. So if I think about the eating disorders treatment community more generally, there's been an almost complete marginalization of analytic thinking and of any kind of depth psychology altogether. And that's, you know, for complex reasons that I think we referenced earlier. And then I think within the analytic community, there's only just starting to be an appreciation, I believe, of what other modalities, other forms of intervention have to offer. And in particular, taking empirical research seriously, taking the need for, you know, other forms of intervention, family-based therapy, nutritional rehabilitation seriously. So I'd really like to see a kind of conversation between those two camps, so to speak. Start to develop.
So like we were saying, each is always a screen for the other, that what we're calling for is an integration of both and a regard for both.
Yes. Yeah.
Tom, let's close. Tell us a little bit about you and your journey. I mean, you've immersed yourself in this work for so many years and have been so prolific. What are you doing here? Well, how did you get into this?
Yeah, it's been a longstanding interest, you know, beginning back in my doctoral studies. I had a patient in a practicum placement who was a young male with anorexia. And, you know, I was just very struck, very moved by his plight, by his suffering, and really didn't feel equipped to help him fully with the way that I was being trained. So I went on to write a doctoral dissertation about anorexia in males and established a private practice that was near a high school, and so was able to see a lot of young people with eating disorders during that time. And, you know, over time, my interest moved more and more to analytic thinking because I felt that that was the kind of route to deeper change. And so, you know, for the past decade or so, I've just been focused on really trying to articulate how I've understood and tried to help the people that I'm seeing. I think I will see, but I think I'm sort of coming to the end of that project, and maybe we'll be able to move on to other things. But, that has been the focus for the past 10 years or so, is to really kind of get that thinking out there.
Yeah. Do you have any ideas floating around for your next subject? I understand. I don't want to call it something as trite as that.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I do. I mean, the paper I published in JAPA a few years ago about the paternal function in anorexia, and then there was one right before that, which was about the experience of agency. Those two papers were papers about agency as a as a psychoanalytic idea. Uh-huh. And so, you know, we'll see, you know, what kind of time I have over the coming years. But I have some ideas about how I'd like to develop that area more fully.
Uh-huh. Terrific. Tom, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for your book. First of all, I hadn't known you before this book. And this is a series that's put together by Routledge that's very concise. This is 100 and some odd pages, 110 pages. And it really covers the field of the theory and clinical practice of the dynamic approach to the eating disorders. And it is a challenge to be concise. As we all know who try to write, it's easier to write long, and you manage it beautifully. And it's I'm teased by your next series of interests, and I hope you'll keep me and us informed of it so we can stay in touch. So thank you, and thank you for participating. This was great fun.
Thank you so much. It was delightful.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.